Thank you for that introduction. I'm Emmy, and I work for the Wisconsin Division of Public Health and also the University of Wisconsin in the Population Health Sciences Department. And I'm going to give an overview about cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins, or blue-green algae, as we sometimes talk or refer to them. Provide a little bit of background about why this is an emerging public health concern, and then talk a little bit about the program that we've had in Wisconsin for a number of years, tracking illnesses in both human and animals related to harmful algal bloom exposure. So I do not have any financial relationships to disclose. I will disclose, however, that this is my first time in New Orleans, and who knew there's a lot to do at night. So you guys are going to maybe get like my A-minus game today, but hopefully together we will all get it done. All right, so just a little bit about cyanobacteria. For how many people in the audience, just out of curiosity, another flash poll, have heard of this topic before? Okay, excellent. So a lot of people are familiar with this. So maybe you all know already that they're naturally occurring photosynthetic bacteria. In Wisconsin, we have a number of areas that are really heavily agricultural. The land use is primarily agricultural. And because of that, there's a lot of runoff into some of our watersheds. And into some of our really heavily used recreational waters. And this type of nutrient loading is what really fuels blooms. So oftentimes you'll see really significant algal blooms in areas where there is a lot of agricultural runoff. They're also particularly problematic in reservoirs and impoundments, which we also have a number of in Wisconsin, where the Wisconsin River, for example, has been dammed, and now that forms a man-made lake. And so those areas where water exchange is slow, again, a lot of nutrient loading from the surrounding environment, and then not a lot of flushing of that water, of those water bodies, and that really can lead to blooms. And also those tend to be shallow, shallowness is also one of the kind of risk factors for significant blooms. Blooms not only can have exposure to humans and animals through cyanotoxins, but they can also cause oxygen depletion, which can lead to fish kills. So sometimes you'll see in the news, there'll be like this huge beach filled with dead fish, and occasionally that's related to an oxygen depletion event. One of the interesting things about cyanobacteria is that they can really, they're really opportunistic. So they can move throughout the water column and depending on the amount of nutrients and the amount of sunlight available, really find their ideal growing conditions. So for example, if it gets too hot, the surface of a water body, the blooms can move down further into the water column and kind of preserve themselves until conditions are a little more ideal for their continued growth. And then oftentimes you'll see, like for example, on the bottom hand, or the bottom of the screen here, you can see there's a scum that's formed. That's on Lake Winnebago in the central part of Wisconsin. Oftentimes those types of scums will form on the windward side of a water body, so you'll see like a lot of material that's accumulating as a result of wind and wave action. So why are we concerned about this? In part because blue-green algae blooms can produce cyanotoxins. And cyanotoxins are really quite potent toxins and can cause a number of different health effects. And they really depend on what type of, what class of toxin that the bloom produces. In Wisconsin, we most often see microcystin as our most commonly detected cyanotoxin. That's a liver toxin. So oftentimes, and I'll talk in the next slide about symptoms, but oftentimes with exposure to microcystin, we see a lot of GI symptoms. And then anatoxin, which is an acute neurotoxin, that can lead to really rapid decline, especially in animals, in pet dogs in particular. They're really a sentinel species because so often dogs are in the same areas as humans. But unlike most people, they are a little more willing to ingest copious amounts of scummy water. And so oftentimes we see really rapid cardiac arrest in dogs, or respiratory failure, other signs of an acute neurotoxic event. And then saxitoxin, which we don't have a lot of in Wisconsin, but that's usually implicated with paralytic shellfish poisoning. For those of you who are in other areas of the country, that might be a greater issue than we see in Wisconsin. So I've talked a little bit about symptoms, but as you would imagine, like with many toxins, the routes of exposure are kind of go hand in hand with the type of symptoms that you see as a result of exposure. So with skin contact, we see sort of acute dermatitis. Oftentimes there'll be rash, hives, skin blisters, especially in areas underneath swimsuits or life preservers. So you can imagine that if you're getting a scum and the water is kind of accumulating underneath the swim garment, then those cells are held close to the body and oftentimes are not rinsed as the rest of the body would be. So you can have some pretty significant rash, like poison ivy, but for a long time. So really, this is a pretty significant, I think when we think about rash, people are sort of dismissive of that, but it can be pretty significant and cause quite a bit of discomfort. in terms of ingestion, oftentimes people are ingesting water if they're water skiing, perhaps inadvertently taking a big gulp of water when they fall. We see sort of this general GI discomfort. This kind of points out one of the difficult things with this particular type of illness, which is that it's really, really similar to a lot of other things. So this sort of nonspecific GI upset or GI discomfort sounds a lot like norovirus, also sounds a lot like Miller Lite intoxication, which we see a lot of in Wisconsin. So sometimes people will be doing a lot of things out on the water, including drinking or including eating food that's been sitting out all day. So sometimes it can be pretty tricky to pin down if this is a waterborne issue or a health behavior issue or maybe a little bit of both. And then also in terms of inhalation, we do see, especially with aerosolized water droplets, when people are jet skiing through really thick scums, that can aerosolize the algal material and then folks ingest that, and then they can have sort of this hay fever or asthma-like symptoms, which is kind of interesting actually, I think. Okay, so I just wanted to touch on our fish consumption guidance. Jason pointed out, I am now also involved in our fish consumption program in Wisconsin, and so I think I would be remiss, since my funding is now exclusively fish, not to point this out. In Wisconsin, we're really trying to develop more advanced guidance specifically for microcystins, so specifically for that more common cyanotoxin that we see. And right now what we're saying is that we encourage people to, if they're fishing in an area where there's a significant algal bloom, discard the guts, viscera, and skin, so those areas of the fish where we know cyanotoxins have been demonstrated to accumulate. To clean the fillet thoroughly with fresh, clean water, and then, of course, always wash your hands and avoid skin contact if you can during an algal bloom with the water. So I think this is sort of an emerging health issue and an emerging aspect of this particular phenomenon. So we were talking before the session today about how there's a lot of work that has yet to be done on this topic, and I think we're going to see more and more attention to fish consumption because some studies have found that microcystin accumulates in the fillet, a lot of studies have found that it accumulates in the muscle tissue and the liver and other guts of the fish. So right now we are feeling pretty confident about this, but I would say in 5 years, if I'm still doing this project, since I'm often grant-funded and so I slip around, but we may have something different to say about this. So my boss joked that the reason that I got to come here this week is because of Toledo, because everybody's really interested in algal blooms all of a sudden because we had this drinking water crisis in Toledo. So for those of you who did not hear about that, they did hit to microcystin in their finished drinking water because they use Lake Erie as a drinking water source. And they had to have a do not drink advisory for, I think it was 4 days. If anyone's here from Ohio, you can correct me. But it was over the course of a weekend. It was a huge, huge press issue. It was obviously a huge inconvenience to the folks that were living in that area. Cyanotoxins are tricky in finished drinking water because of boiling water lyses the cells, and so you can actually increase the amount of toxin that's soluble and present in the water column. So they had a complete do not drink advisory, which was really a tremendous event for such a large municipality. In Wisconsin, we're fortunate that we actually have most of our drinking water is from groundwater sources. We do have a couple of surface water sources, which are Lakes Winnebago, Michigan, and Superior. And the one that we're particularly interested in and concerned about is Lake Winnebago. So that's up, for anyone who's a Packer fan, up by the city of Green Bay. And Lake Winnebago has blooms every year. I shouldn't say that. It's really not that close to Green Bay. It's closer to Appleton and Nina Menasha, but probably most of you won't really know the difference. But there are really significant blooms on Lake Winnebago, and there are a number of researchers, some from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, who are doing some really interesting in situ work in Lake Winnebago to try to understand what the toxins are in that water body, and also try to make sure that we're really routinely monitoring them very rigorously in the finished drinking water. Okay. So I'm going to be very brief with this part because this is like what I'm really interested in, probably from a programmatic standpoint. Not everyone else is very interested in this, but we had a 5-year grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that funded us to do harmful algal bloom illness surveillance. The objectives for that project were to identify, evaluate, and report cases of both human and animal illness related to cyanobacteria in Wisconsin. We are also developing our outreach capacity both to increase general awareness of the potential health hazard posed by algae and then also to try to develop our case reporting pathways so that, you know, the more people that know about this, the more people we're hearing about if they do get sick. And then we had really strong partnerships with our state Department of Natural Resources and our state lab of hygiene as well, who are responsible for our water sampling and analysis. So we hear about illnesses at the state of Wisconsin in a couple different ways. Probably the most frequent one is through direct contact, either with myself or other staff in our office. We also developed a report-a-case tool for electronic case reporting through our website. As I mentioned, oftentimes folks are out on the water, they're swimming, they're doing a lot of other activities, and if they get sick over the weekend and they don't get a hold of me by Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, they're not as interested in reporting their illness, or they've already attributed it to some of those other causes. And so this is a way for us to capture that illness information in real time. We also have a reporting pathway with our poison center. So we have an automated case notification system that I'll talk about in a little bit more detail. There's our website. There's our little online reporting tool. And so with our, I'm just going to talk briefly about our Wisconsin Poison Center work. So what happens is we did some training and some outreach with our Poison Control Center, and then the RN staff that are the folks who are answering the phone when people call the Poison Center, they can then generate a specific case ID, and then that triggers an email to myself and other staff in our office, and then we can follow up directly with the ill individual. So this is just another way for us to try to expand our case reporting pathways. So just briefly, what happens essentially when we get a report of an illness, we usually check in with our regional DNR partners to check and see whether they are aware of a bloom on a particular water body. Oftentimes they'll go out and do a visual inspection, and then they'll say, no way, there's nothing going on, or, oh yeah, we need to do a water sample. So we kind of work with the local regional DNR staff, who are then responsible for pulling a water sample if we decide that that's warranted. And then we stage these sampling kits, so they're like styrofoam boxes that are staged throughout the state, so that if they decide to take a sample, they can do that as quickly as possible, because we want to try to reduce, you know, the amount of time between when the exposure occurred and when the sample is taken as much as we possibly can. And then those are shipped overnight via FedEx to the State Lab of Hygiene, who then is responsible for doing the sampling. And then the State Lab of Hygiene reports those results out to us. And then in Wisconsin, we have our local staff are the ones that are responsible for issuing the health advisory. So what do we see? Typically we see between 35, and last year was crazy how few reports we had, about 15 case reports related to harmful algal blooms across the state each summer. So keeping in mind that our beach season is like 6 weeks long, not really, but it's pretty short. You know, other states probably have a longer period of time when folks are swimming, when they're recreating, and so they have, in general, a little bit greater case reporting. And then you can see that we have the majority of our cases involve some sort of gastrointestinal issue as well. And what these colored columns refer to is, in Wisconsin we use the World Health Organization guidance for making a decision about whether we're going to issue a health alert, or excuse me, a health advisory. So anything with a water sample above 100,000 cells per milliliter, that's considered to be a high risk of an adverse health event. So those are in red. And then in orange there, you can see those sort of moderate risk, which is between 20,000 and 100,000 cells per mil. And you can see that in toxins, we detected them in some of the samples, but not all. So I just want to show you another slide about that quickly. So on this slide, you can see that on the top half of each one of these circles are our cell densities. So those would be like the 100,000 cells per mil. And then on the bottom half is the total microcystin. So this is kind of our like rough, almost qualitative way of looking at, okay, when we see really high cell counts, are we also seeing high levels of toxin, or at least some detection of toxin? And I would say, in general, as an anecdotal statement, yes-ish. I would say we're more conservative than we probably need to be. Oftentimes we have high cell counts, but we don't then detect toxin. The tricky thing about detecting cyanotoxin is that oftentimes the blooms are producing toxin, and then they're not. We're really not all that sure about what the conditions are that would warrant toxin production, and oftentimes it's really fleeting, and so you might get toxin detect on one day and then not the next day. So it's a pretty tricky from an environmental science sampling standpoint. Because I'm just going to talk very briefly about our outreach and program sustainability. As probably many of you in the audience have done, we've done a lot of press releases. You can see me down there looking grim in my YouTube video. So we've tried to do a lot of outreach with our local partners to help do some health education about harmful algal blooms. We've also done a number of targeted trainings for local health departments and lake managers. We now have a Great Lakes Restoration funded CSTE fellow who's doing coordinating our waterborne work. So that's really exciting because when our CDC grant was completed last fall, we didn't really have any dedicated state funding for this project, this type of work. But now that we have a CSTE fellow, that's really enabled us to build on the capacity that we had kind of developed as a framework under the HAVIS grant. So this is, I think, my second to last slide, which is just sort of our overall guidance. What we encourage folks to do is to, you know, really use a when in doubt, stay out type approach. So when you see water that's really discolored, that's often an indication of poor water quality. We always remind people to shower and wash their hands after they've been swimming in any body of water. Then we can talk a little bit. I mentioned the fish consumption guidance. And really importantly, I'm a huge, tremendous dog lover, and it's always very, very sad when I get those phone calls saying that a pet has died. And so we really have tried to do a lot more outreach with our veterinarians to try to capture the cases that are happening in companion animals, and also to make sure that they're increasing their own client base level of awareness about this. Whew, got through those last three slides in just a couple of minutes. So I think we're going to wait on questions. Is that correct?
I think we can do questions now.
Okay. Yeah.
That was a great presentation. Thank you so much. And I'm glad that this is touched on the animals. I just have a question on a couple of small questions for a bigger topic. First one is, what is the surveillance system that the state of Wisconsin uses, the routine surveillance system? How reliable are the people who are reporting, self-reporting through that system?
I'm going to try to summarize because it might be hard. So for folks who were not able to hear the question, there was a question about what our case surveillance system is, and then also how reliable the folks are that are calling or who are reporting their illness. And so I think I'll start with the second half of that first, which is I think they're mostly reliable. So I think it's a little bit tricky because we don't have a biomarker for this particular disease or illness, and so oftentimes it's a sort of a process of elimination. So it's no, it's not Noro because of some reason, or no, it's, you know, we have some at least water quality sampling so we can say that, you know, we know what the environmental conditions are and they match what you're reporting in terms of your symptoms. But again, because the illness is relatively nonspecific, we've sort of gone back and forth in terms of casting a really wide net, I think, in the first couple years of the program, and then trying to be a little bit more cautious with our diagnosis going forward. And so we use a sort of health complaints language about that's how many people called with a health complaint that also included some sort of environmental description that would indicate to us that there may be a bloom present. And then I'm not sure in terms of our case or in terms of our case surveillance, we had this HABIS program, so the CDC developed this online database, and that's what we had been using. And now actually then folks maybe are familiar with NORS, the National Outbreak Reporting System. And so under NORS, we're really excited because NORS is going to be a way better database than HABIS ever was. Sorry, CDC. Oh boy, I'm getting recorded. And so we're excited to be able to partner with NORS because I think that's a much more robust way of collecting the data. So they already have a waterborne section, so they're just putting in a HAB module in the NORS system. Yeah? So her question was about what do we do once we have a health advisory? You know, what's the follow-up? And, you know, that depends a little bit on the local municipality. And that's a really good question, and it's a really tricky answer because some communities are able to do follow-up water testing, and some communities, so the sampling for just the cell density is about $140, $150. So it's not super expensive. The testing for toxin right now in Wisconsin, I think it's $470 per test. And so very few communities can do routine monitoring of toxin. I can't think of any that are doing that, with the exception of Dane County, which is around the capital, the city of Madison. And they use dipstick testing. And so then in that instance, they do go out and they retest. So if they have a water quality advisory like the one that you see on the screen right now, they'll go out and do a dipstick test, which is like a are really fast, sort of semi-quantitative, yes, microcystin is present, and yes, it's above 12 micrograms per liter. Oftentimes, that's probably the only community that's doing that level of monitoring, I would say, on their bathing beaches. A lot of other communities will do a visual inspection and say, they'll put up like an advisory sign, but they won't have a closure. And so they'll say, okay, when you see scum, that's an indication that there's algae present, so try to swim someplace else. Does that kind of answer your question? Okay, great.
Yeah.
What are they doing to reduce agricultural runoff?
So the question was about what's going on to reduce agricultural runoff. And one of the things that they're doing in a couple of areas of the state are they're creating TMDLs. So I don't know if anyone is familiar with the TMDL. It's a total maximum daily load, and they are specifically doing that for phosphorus, which is really kind of the limiting factor for algal growth and the biggest promoter of algal growth. So they're trying to understand, okay, in this watershed, how much phosphorus can this watershed healthily handle? And then that's kind of the first step, I would say, in terms of saying, this is the amount that the watershed can deal with, and where are we at now, and then how do we back off in terms of how much is going into the water. I know our state DNR partners are trying to work on watershed remediation. They're doing smaller projects. One in particular in a really tricky area of the state, which has very significant blooms, they've done created a new shoreline zoning ordinance to try to control what was happening really on a very sort of micro level in their watershed. So they were doing restoring the riparian zone, doing a lot of remediation of the shoreline, and they were also moving towards controlling phosphorus in the products that were available in their community. Wisconsin does have a ban now on phosphorus in lawn fertilizers, detergents, with the exception that you can still go to the hardware store and purchase it if you ask for it, but it's not available on the shelves anymore. So there are some larger initiatives that are going on. I think we have a long way to go. Obviously, when you look at these photos, we have a long way to go. So the question was about whether Wisconsin was involved in the National Lakes Assessment Survey, and yes. I don't know, I probably shouldn't speak to that, to what all that was, because I don't know very well. There's been, the DNR did like a large microcystin monitoring project in Wisconsin in maybe 2002, I think, and found microcystin, I think, almost everywhere they looked for it throughout the state, and so I don't know the specifics of what happened with our our lakes assessment, though.
All right, we'll do one more way in the back, and then after the presentation and stuff, you all will sit on and have more conversation. So, in the back. You might need to speak up, though, a little bit, because it's just loud.
So the question was about whether we have any data about foodborne illness related to algae, so folks that have gotten sick from consuming fish, for example, and whether NORS will be able to capture that and how it will be captured in NORS, whether it will be a foodborne or a waterborne outbreak. And I believe it will be a foodborne outbreak. I don't see my food friend here, our food epi, but that would be a question for him, actually, more so than for myself. And then I don't think we've had anyone in Wisconsin who's gotten acutely ill from cyanotoxins. Oftentimes people think of Vibrio and PSP as kind of all in the same category. We have had cases of Vibrio, but we haven't had anyone who's been ill, acutely ill, as a result of microcystin in fish.
All right.
Thank you very much, everyone.
So